Uncovered, a true crime podcast. My name is Emma.
And I'm Lily. I almost forgot to say my name.
Nope. I was going to say, we almost nailed that first try, but
well,
guess not. I just, you know, we just want to give a quick little apology to our listeners.
Yeah.
I've had multiple people contact me saying, are you still doing the podcast? Yes, I've just been violently ill. So,
yeah.
I don't know what to tell you. I'm sorry.
Sorry, guys.
Yeah. Pregnancy is no joke. Wasn't expecting this.
Yeah.
And I'm also going to be double honest and apologize again because we've already recorded this episode, but my silly, goosey little self didn't save the recording. Oh. And then the computer shut off and it got deleted. So
she was just being a little silly goose.
Lily has already heard this episode.
I have.
I have already read this episode. I think it was about an hour and a half of recording.
Yeah, something like that.
And now we have to do it over again. But that's okay. We're going to have fun.
That's all right. Here we go.
I guess I don't have any other things to preface this with.
Yeah.
Unless, what did we talk about last time?
I think you just kind of talked about your pregnancy, like, oh, I'm pregnant.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I guess this is our official. Yeah. If you don't know or you don't follow me on Instagram, you're probably like, what?
Wait a second.
No, yes. I'm pregnant. And last week, trigger warning, puking, I guess, because this is just a fun fact I like to tell people. I threw up within 3 days, the 3 days that I was sick, I threw up 28 times, guys.
That's a lot of times.
It's a lot of time. And, like, people are like, why did you count? Because I wanted to. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Are you ready?
Yeah,
Feel free to do whatever you'd like to do while I read this. Okay, welcome back to part two. Strange Death of Vincent Foster. Before I get into it, I just want to clear up again. I'm not saying this entire case was some scheme from a powerful family involved in this story. I'm just here to show you how mishandled cases are sometimes, just like this one. Because not only was his death tragic, but it was also very, very mishandled, which is another tragedy in itself.
I agree that it was very mishandled.
It was disgustingly mishandled.
Yeah, it was gross.
Okay. I'm just here to present as much evidence as I can fit into a podcast and let y'all come to your own conclusions, because we stand critical thinking in this household.
Yes.
And also because I don't want to get sued, honest. Super fun fact, there is a map of Fort Marcy Park in the book, and I just had not seen it yet, but yeah, you know how, like, books will sometimes have, like, pictures in the middle?
Yes.
On, like, different kind of paper?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was some of those. So I'm gonna be taking pictures of the book and posting them
for this case. That'll be nice.
So it'll be very, very helpful for your eyes and your ears and your brain. Yeah. Oh, also, there's going to be a few drawings of how the body was found, and they're not, like, actual photos of Vincent Foster's body, because they lost those photos, first of all. Second of all, they're not going to be graphic or anything, so don't be, like, you know, turned off by that. Like, oh, I don't want to go to the Instagram and see those. No, it's just going to show you how the body was found and some blood patterns I'll get into later in this episode.
That's so interesting. I like that.
Dude, I know. In the last episode, I ended around the note that was found in Foster's bag and plenty of weird detective work from the park police. If you're just jumping into this podcast and you're starting with this episode, then please don't, because you're going to be really, really, really confused. So please go start with part one. Unless you don't want to start with part one, free will is a thing. So do whatever your little heart desires, but I would highly encourage you.
I would, yes, suggest that you do that.
Because if I jumped in on this episode, I'd be like, huh?
Yeah, what? I'd be really confused.
You know, and since it's been so long, maybe go listen to part one again.
Yeah, honestly. Also, like, this is such a detailed case.
It is.
That if you skip part one, you're going to be so confused.
Yeah, because, like, everything ties into everything. And if you don't know what's going on, then you're going to
You
be
do
real
a really
lost.
Good job, though, of explaining
thank
it.
Thank you so
Cause,
much.
Because, like, I was a little confused, but then as you started explaining more and more, I was like, okay, I see it now.
I feel like I went into a little too much detail because, like, I'm not a visual person. No, I am a visual person. I'm not I want to say Audible, but that's the Amazon app. Is Audible a word? No, because there's Audibly.
Yeah, it's.
I'm not an audio person.
You can't picture it.
Yeah,
just
if
by
I hear
hearing it.
Yeah, if I hear it,
it has
I'm
to
not
be really detailed.
It. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, if you're like me, then I did this for you. I'm just gonna jump right in.
All right.
Okay, here we go.
Here we go.
Again, I use this, the Okay, wait, short shout out to Lily and Silas, because while I've been dying the past couple weeks, they've been really nice.
Aww.
Lily's been great. She's been like,
thanks.
What can I do? How can I help? Love you.
Love you.
Shout out to Silas too, the editor.
Yeah.
Also my husband, whatever.
The best editor.
The best editor. He's been kind of slacking lately though. Kidding, we all have.
True.
The book that I used, The Strange Death of Vincent Foster by Christopher Ruddy, to create this podcast, 10 out of 10 read. Go read it if you haven't, because I can't fit all of the information in here, because if I tried to, this episode would be like 40 hours long. Mm. And I don't think any of us want that. I think we want to put Vince Foster to rest.
Yeah, we want to let that boy.
Parts. Yeah, we have one more part after this one, and then we're done. We're done.
Yep.
So let's get into the autopsy, shall we?
All right.
There's nothing very interesting found, actually, which is disappointing but not surprising.
Yeah, no.
The doctor who performed this autopsy was really buddy-buddy with the FBI. He taught lectures at Quantico, kind of buddy-buddy with the FBI.
Hmm.
The autopsy was to be performed on July 21st, 1993. Oh, I had to burp. To be performed on July 21st, 1993. So obviously very soon after everything went down. And the lead Park Police investigator, John Rolla, called Dr. James Beyer, who would be doing the autopsy, and told him to schedule it for Thursday. This would give everyone time to get a good night's rest and be available to be present at the autopsy. And by everyone, I mean FBI and Park Police, in case they needed to answer any questions about the scene, since Dr. Beyer was not present at the scene. So they were kind of just there to answer any questions that the autopsy technician might have.
Okay.
Because, I mean, that kind of makes sense to me, not going to lie. But yeah. Again, Park Police?
Girl. Don't get me started.
So, here's the weird thing. The White House ended up pulling some strings to get the autopsy moved up to Wednesday at 10 a.m., so the day after Foster was found in the park, and lead Park Police investigator Rolla decided not to attend because he would be too tired. Understandable, not gonna lie. He's yeah. Park Police, too. Like,
yeah,
I guess right. He shouldn't even have been there in the first place. We should probably stop to say, you know, we talk a lot of smack about the Park Police around these parts.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't find a clear answer on if they have, like, clearance and jurisdiction that it looks like they have in this case. I don't know if they were just on this case because he just happened to be found in a park.
Yeah, it's so confusing because when I hear Park Police, I think of, like, basically just security.
I think of, like, Smokey the Bear.
That too.
Only you can stop forest fires. Only you can stop murders in the park. Murder? Who said murder?
What?
What? Anyways, okay. Oh, here's a funny thing. Police walked in to attend the autopsy and Beyer was being assisted by an unidentified male, which in this case he's a White House official. There should not be anybody unidentified.
Uh huh.
Working
strange
around this, and police obviously were like, "Who the heck is this?" And Beyer, the autopsy technician, kind of flipped out and was like. And literally said, quote, "You are dealing with me here. You don't need his name," end quote. Okay, Mr. Beyer.
That's so weird.
I know.
This whole thing is just weird.
Dude, I know. Like, every sentence, I'm just like, that's weird. That's
yep.
weird.
Yep.
All that was found during this autopsy was residue of gunpowder soot on Foster's left and right index fingers, and everything else was very consistent with your, I hate to say, I say typical for lack of a better word, but your typical suicide
yeah.
autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
Some controversy came about in January of 1994 when Christopher Ruddy, our boy,
mm-hmm.
we stan him in this household.
Our bestie.
He interviewed James Beyer, the autopsy technician, and Beyer informed him that members of the FBI and Park Police were present at the autopsy, and this would make sense considering that Beyer wasn't present on the scene. Oh, I already talked about that. I forgot to take that out. Remember that? I did that last time, too.
Oh, yeah, you did.
Anyways.
Silly. I still feel like I can't hear you, and it's making me nervous. But it's probably fine.
I don't know how to fix it.
I know. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. Loud and clear.
Oh, so as I just yelled at you.
Can you hear me? No, I can hear you fine.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my apology. Here, maybe, should you have these ones so you can hear what I'm saying?
It's okay. I mean, I don't care.
Are you sure?
Yeah, it's not.
I'll see if Silas can fix it when he gets home.
Okay.
So the FBI later completely contradicted Beyer's claims that their agents were with him at the autopsy. So now the FBI is saying, we weren't there. We weren't there.
Suspicious.
Even though when Christopher Reddy interviewed Beyer, Beyer was like, yeah, they were there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's just so many inconsistencies everywhere.
Yeah.
It's pathetic.
It's really irritating also.
Yeah. It sounded like the park police and the FBI that were present at the autopsy, they didn't give the technician any additional information. Like, even just basic information. Like, Beyer didn't even know what kind of caliber the gun was mm-hmm. that was used. Like, he was given nothing. They were kind of just there to watch, I guess. In Beyer's first initial report of the autopsy, he didn't rule it as a suicide, actually. This is because, according to him, he doesn't get to make that ruling. By Virginia law, the police do, which I find interesting. Let's see if autopsy technicians usually do autopsy techs rule cause of death. big words. Yeah, Google didn't come up with like one of those little answer boxes, so I'm not gonna dive into it.
Annoying.
Maybe I'll put it in the Instagram caption if I figure it out.
Yeah.
Where was I? Oh yeah, so according to Virginia law, Beyer was just kind of there to like note things and complete the autopsy, do the little sheets, all the paperwork and stuff, and he ended up telling Ruddy directly that, quote, it is consistent with a self-inflicted gunshot wound, but that statement doesn't appear in any autopsy report. Which you'd think it would.
Mm-hmm.
The controversy began, though, when during some Senate hearings in 1994, Beyer insisted that he did in fact rule Foster's death as a suicide. Now, that's weird, considering he was like, oh no, Virginia law, the police have to, so,
yeah,
make up your mind.
I know, this whole case is, that's the theme.
Yeah.
Just make up your mind.
Just make up your mind, what happened? This may have been to save himself some embarrassment on behalf of not only himself, but also the FBI. But can you guess who messed this up?
Park police.
Correct.
Last time I was like,
the Clintons? So the park police had actually been informing the press that the autopsy technician did in fact rule the death a suicide when that was not true.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be revisiting a lot of information in these episodes, but bear with me, please. Going back to how the gun was fired and how a theory is that someone could have possibly switched out guns, since a .38 caliber just seems quite too large to have inflicted this wound.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the .38 caliber was found in Foster's hand, but the damage is more consistent with a .22 caliber gun, and both scenarios are very strange, and again, if you remember, it's presumed that Foster put the, trigger warning. Oh, we should probably talk about trigger warning.
Yeah.
Trigger warning, suicide, trigger warning, violence, trigger warning, blood, trigger warning, death.
Yeah. It's a true crime podcast. We say that every time.
I know. So yeah, there's your trigger warning. So I'm going to kind of go into detail about what is presumed on how Foster ended up passing away, tragically. It's presumed that he put the barrel of the gun towards the back of his mouth and then pulled the trigger, and this would have caused major damage to his teeth from the recoil, either chipping his teeth or knocking some of them out entirely, and there would have been plenty of gunpowder residue all over his mouth, especially his tongue, but there was none. This was baffling to everyone involved, since there was barely any residue inside his mouth. Another theory they had... Oh, I said that wrong.
Was he... His teeth weren't chipped and he wasn't missing
his mouth was perfectly fine. There was no residue in his mouth. His teeth were fine. Like, there was no tissue blowback, which I think I'm going to talk about in a second.
Mm-hmm.
Since there was barely any residue inside his mouth, another theory is that maybe he held the gun outside of his mouth and just aimed it towards the back of his throat. And this has issues as well, because it would have left residue on his face, burning his skin, as well as damaging his lips. So we're kind of at a loss here either way.
Yeah.
But no matter what, the .22 caliber would make more sense given the evidence on the body.
Mm-hmm. Also, just like the way he would have had to hold the gun is just...
Yeah.
So weird.
I know. So out of this world.
Yeah.
Especially since if a .22 caliber was used, it would make a remarkably smaller exit wound than noted in Beyer's autopsy report, and there is supporting evidence that it was indeed smaller than what was put on the autopsy report. This is another super cute piece of information. The Fairfax County EMT worker who placed Foster's deceased body into a body bag later noted that he did not see or notice any kind of exit wound on the back of Foster's head. Mm. And this man had to cradle his head in the back of his neck to help guide Foster's body into the body bag. Now, that obviously isn't definitive evidence to say that there wasn't an exit wound at all. I'm just saying
he might have felt something.
Yeah, in every aspect of this case, there's some person contradicting another person.
Yep.
In everywhere you look. Mm-hmm. There was another eyewitness. We've been recording for 22 minutes already.
Dang.
I feel like I've been talking for like 2 seconds. I'm like blowing through this thing.
Well, yeah, you've done it once too, so you're very like...
Yeah, this is going to be a pretty quick episode, but don't worry, guys. The next episode's going to be chatty.
Yeah.
There was another eyewitness, actually, who gave information about the exit wound who was on scene, and that was Dr. Hout, the medical examiner, who stated the exit wound was consistent with a, quote, low-velocity weapon, which a .22 caliber gun is considered a low-velocity weapon. So as everything else in this case, there's some disagreements and non-supporting evidence as to exactly where the exit wound was on the body. They can't even get the exit wound right.
Yeah.
Park police kept repeating the description up and out, referring to the angle of the gun when it was fired, which sounds normal given all the stories we've heard already, and it would be very consistent with the self-inflicted gunshot wound. Mm-hmm. But going back to our boy, Dr. Donald Hout, he wrote in his reports that the gunshot wound was a self-inflicted gunshot wound, mouth to neck, which is most certainly not what has been told and not consistent with suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is all well and fine because this little inconsistency could have been cleared with x-rays, but they lost the x-rays.
Dude. It's just, like, frustrating and kind of sad that I know, people like, that...
this is somebody's life.
Yeah, like, somebody's life, and then these people, like, they're being trusted with stuff.
Yeah.
And this is their job. This is literally what they're getting paid to do.
Yeah, you're getting paid to do this.
And like, no one is doing it correctly.
Give his, like, his family answers. Give right. his friends answers. Something.
Yeah.
But no, I just feel like everyone was so, like, loosey-goosey.
Yeah, it's, with, like...
It's yeah. really sad and upsetting.
Yeah. Anyways.
Dr. Beyer checked the yes box for x-rays on the autopsy report, but when later asked, he basically said, yeah, my bad. They were actually... The x-ray machine was actually inoperable at the time, so no x-rays. I could have taken them, though, but that means I would have had to transport everything to another facility, and I really didn't want to do that, but I really don't recall. So... sorry about that one.
Dude.
Yeah. So, one running theory is that these x-rays were destroyed because it showed one of these two things, or perhaps both of these things. One is that there was a wound that may have incapacitated Foster before the fatal shot was fired, hence the wound that was written off as a bloodstain on his jawline.
Mm-hmm. I remember about that.
Yeah, in the last episode.
Yeah.
Or two, the x-rays show that the bullet was not up and out like how it was described by most investigators, including, or mainly, Park Police.
Mm.
And I cannot stand the Park Police for many reasons, but another one being that they just make stuff up in their reports and public statements. And after doing a screening of Foster's blood and urine post-mortem, there's absolutely no drugs found in his systems, in his system, including any antidepressants. But in the Park Police's public statement, they claimed that Foster had taken one antidepressant pill the evening before his death. Just one, Your Honor. Just... these nails, dude, they're too long. Just one. Just one pill.
Only one.
Only one. Only one.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Beyer's autopsy on Foster only took about an hour. Only an hour.
Oh, yeah, we looked this up last time.
Yeah, yeah, for a high-ranking mm-hmm. White House official. According to Google, the average autopsy takes between 2 to 4 hours, and I don't know how trustworthy that is, but whatever.
If you're an autopsy technician, let us know.
Yeah, please let us know. I think last time, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was something like, if you were to die of a heart attack, then, like, the autopsy would take more or so, like, 2 hours.
Yeah, something like that.
And then if it's, like, murder or suicide, then it's closer to, like, the four-hour and up mark.
Yeah, I feel like I remember you reading that.
But, oh, maybe it wasn't, like, a heart attack. It was, like, just, like, death of natural causes or something.
Yeah, something like that.
It takes, like, 2 hours. But, no, this one took an hour.
Yeah, weird.
He took irretrievable pieces of evidence, like hair and fingerprints, but the fingerprints turned out to not be usable. Because why would they? And the White House also didn't have a set of Foster's fingerprints.
Which everyone's supposed to have, right?
That, I mean, I'm assuming everyone who works in the White House would have a set of fingerprints on file.
Yeah.
Or even, like you have to get your fingerprints taken, not all of them.
Yeah.
Only one when you, like, get your license.
Yeah, well, and I applied to work at a daycare, and I got the job, and I had to give mm-hmm. them my fingerprints.
Yeah, so I'm sure if you have to have your fingerprints on file for a daycare, you probably have to have them on file if you work in the White House.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they didn't have a set on file either. As if that's not suspicious already, park police muck up their job once again.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Couldn't see that coming.
Park police did not muck up this job. Well, they kind of helped. It was kind of a team effort with the police and the park police. The police were in charge of gathering Foster's clothing, which, thank God, finally the police are in charge of something, not the park police. And they're in charge of gathering all of his clothing and putting it into evidence bags. And they admitted to breaking rule number one when it comes to evidence. They mixed bloodied and non-bloodied items together in one bag, cross-contaminating all of the evidence and making it all useless. And park police just watched. They just stood by and watched.
They didn't say, Hey, excuse me.
Let me just double check really quick.
Excuse me.
Hey. Yeah.
Don't do that.
Excuse me. So Foster's jacket and tie were found in his car, and it was bagged and sent straight to Park Police Labs without going to the coroner first, which I'm assuming that was written because that's like standard protocol that it would like go to the coroner. Like I've said before, why do Park Police? That's just my question.
Same.
This is a little humorous to me now, though. Everyone kept harping on this little indentation on Foster's right thumb.
I remember this.
This is pathetic. And they tried to sell this off as conclusive evidence that Foster had pulled the trigger, because Republican Congressman William Klinger said, and I quote, "The most critical picture for me, again, is the indentation on his thumb, because this particular weapon recoils in a way that puts an indentation on your thumb." This is not true. They're not even sure the type of gun that was used, so how can you know that, Mr. Republican Congressman? He can't.
Nope.
He can't, because he's dumb.
Yep.
This isn't just my expertise speaking, because Dr. DeMeo agrees and said this impression to form is, quote, virtually impossible, and he had never even heard of something like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dr. Charles Petty said, you are no more likely to see it than you would find an imprint of the steering wheel on the hand of someone who died in a car accident.
Yep.
Which is a great way to put it. Mm-hmm. So, how did this impression in... Did I say impression? Yeah, impression.
You
did
that last time.
I know. Well, because I put depression right here.
Oh.
How did this impression on his thumb get here? Since the gun was found in his hand, it may have just been an indentation from the gun lying on his hand for a couple hours. But this indentation is obviously not clear evidence that the trigger was pulled by Foster himself. Mm-hmm. That made me wheeze.
Yeah,
the authority.
It's really funny.
In which actually. He said it was just...
He weasible. Knew.
Oh, he knows.
He believed it in his soul. He knows.
Oh, my God. Oh, my goodness.
Also, I'm not typing up my thing right now because I feel like the keys when I type. You're going to hear it.
That is a possibility.
So that's why I didn't do it, because I did not want to mess up this one, take.
We're going to get this one.
It's fine. Yeah, we are.
Let's do a little recap of everything that was messed up just to refresh ourselves. No x-rays. No effort was made to find even an approximate time of death. They mixed up Foster's clothing, making all of it completely useless. The toxicology test did not run anything for exotic drugs,
mm-hmm.
and the amount of time the autopsy took was not acceptable at all. According to Christopher Ruddy, for a routine autopsy of someone who... Here it is.
All right, here we go.
According to Christopher Ruddy... Oh, I was right. For a routine autopsy of someone who died from a stroke or heart attack, it would still take around 2 hours, and bullet wounds specifically take a much longer time, probably up towards the 4-hour mark,
mm-hmm.
like I mentioned before.
Which makes sense.
It does. Moving out of the autopsy and back to Bill Clinton.
Hmm.
As we discussed in part one, Clinton went on the Larry King live show the night that Foster was found dead, which I know it shouldn't, for lack of a better word, I'm going to say funny. I find that funny
mm-hmm.
that Clinton was on the Larry King live show. There's big speculation whether the White House staff was notified about Foster's death at around 7 and 8:30 p.m., which, again, this seems like a simple point, and the White House staff argues over it, apparently, a lot. One reason they could be worried about the timing is they wanted to make sure that no one was allowed in Foster's office after his death and that it would be properly sealed off. Now, Park Police never sealed Foster's office, which is apparently their job.
Mm-hmm.
Make it make sense.
They just are something.
Yeah, when did they ever do their job? Did we expect the office to get sealed off? No.
No.
Now, get this. Intruder alarm was turned off in the council suite around 7 p.m. And the most told story is that the body was found at 6 p.m., White House notified at 8:30, and the president and other higher officials were notified last at around 10 p.m. And this is interesting. The Park Police claimed they didn't realize Foster was a White House official until, quote, late into the investigation. Now, because this entire case is conflicting information or things that didn't happen, one of the FBI statements claimed that they had members of the FBI and the SWAT team on site at Fort Marcy Park only 45 minutes after first responders arrived. But if they didn't know this was the death of a high-ranking official until, quote, late into the investigation, like the Park Police had claimed, who told... Well, I think I meant to say SWAT team. Who told the SWAT team to go there?
Yeah.
Who told the FBI to go there?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean... And now, oh, we need to clear this up as well. We did last time we recorded this. But we don't know anything, guys.
Exactly.
We don't claim, or even, I hope it doesn't sound like we
know
act
yeah.
like we know anything.
We don't.
Because we don't. We're learning right along with you guys.
Yep.
And if you guys know, let us know.
Mm-hmm.
We would love to learn.
Yes.
But I know nothing. Like, when it comes to, like, trials and stuff.
I know nothing.
Crime, I'm lost.
Yep, me too.
I'm confused. Protocol, I'm lost.
Yep.
Like this, is it protocol for the FBI to go to a scene of a death? I think it is, actually, because one time on my way to a volleyball game, I told this story last time.
Yeah, I remember this.
A lady got hit in the road and she died, and there was an FBI van there. And that kind of makes sense, I guess, for FBI to show up.
Yeah.
Because they don't know what's going on. They don't know if it was a murder.
Right.
They don't know. But SWAT team?
Yeah.
Is it, the only, like, thing that I can think of is the SWAT team showed up, or allegedly showed up. We don't even know if they actually did.
Yeah.
To, like, in case it was, like, a shooting, you know?
Right.
But, yeah.
Yeah,
because
strange.
Going back, one person did, said they were, like, never saw the gun in Foster's hands. I don't know.
This whole case is, I don't know.
Yeah. And we also don't know.
We don't. Because... We're pretty dumb, actually.
We are. We are. And we'll be honest about that.
Yeah.
So, if that's not weird enough, that whole speculation about the SWAT team and the FBI, the Park Police made a weird comment about not knowing or even denying the presence of FBI and SWAT. So, again, who even knows what actually happened?
Right, exactly.
Nobody does. This is my other favorite piece of contradicting information. Okay. This is going to be a lot of times, so pay attention. Cheryl Braun said that she searched Foster's car at 7 p.m. She found his White House identification, and she asked Lieutenant Watson to call Lieutenant Gavin, who was the shift commander on duty that night. The officer apparently failed to make that call. So Cheryl Braun called Gavin herself between 7:30 and 7:45, so 30 to 45 minutes after she allegedly found Foster's White House identification card. Gavin stated that once he received the call from Cheryl Braun, Cheryl's a girl's name, right? Cheryl's a girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. He called the White House no more than 10 minutes after receiving that call, so it should have been no later than 8 o'clock. White House claimed they were told at 8:30, so there's nothing to account for that 30-minute gap of time, and on top of that, it took an additional 45 minutes to notify the presidential aides and the president himself. So that's Cheryl's story. Let's get into Investigator Rolla's statement.
All right.
Gavin claims that it was Investigator Rolla, not Cheryl Braun, that informed him of Foster's death. But that's not even the weird part, because in his FBI statement and sworn deposition, Rolla claimed that it was him searching Foster's Honda, not Braun, and that it was much later that the White House ID card was found, like after the body had been taken away at around 8:30 p.m., kind of later when the ID card was found. But then again, and probably not our last contradicting statement, FBI claims that he knew Foster was a White House official around 6:40 when they left. Mm-hmm. So who can we depend on in this case?
No one.
That's exactly what I wrote. this is a cute little side note.
All right.
Towards the end of the Fisk investigation, did we talk about that we know who Fisk is?
Report.
Okay. Guys.
Last time we did, but this time.
In our first episode, I was like, what is a Fisk? What is a Fisk report? His name is Robert B. Fisk. He's an investigator.
And he reported.
And he was hired to do an investigation on this, and he reported on it, and that's why it's called Fisk Reports. So
that's probably one of our funniest.
It is. See, we don't know anything.
Exactly. There you go. That's a perfect example of how much we know.
We're learning together, guys.
Right, exactly.
So towards the end of the Fisk investigation in 1994, a young woman came forward. She was a makeup artist for CNN and had done Bill Clinton's makeup that night for the Larry King show. She claimed that around 9 p.m. an aide came in to tell the president that a note or document had been found in Foster's office and that she clearly saw the president acknowledge this remark. This raises two problems. This would mean that there were people in Foster's office before they said there had been, and if this statement was true, it would mean the president knew about Foster's death about an hour before official statement said he was informed. Now, there are some more little things that would show that the White House knew about Foster's death before they said they did. Long story short, the Clinton's nanny... This is weird. The Clinton's nanny was informed through a White House doorman, so she made a call to the president to confirm. And then the Arkansas governor... Why was the nanny calling the governor? That's my question.
That's just... That doesn't seem real.
Yeah, like, you're a nanny. You're not a, like, a secretary.
Yeah, right.
Anyways, that final call to the governor happened no later than 8 p.m. So 2 hours before Bill Clinton supposedly knew the nanny, his nanny confirmed it with him. 2 hours before he allegedly knew. Side note, I went to post the pictures for last episode, and I came across a ton of articles saying that Hillary Clinton and Vincent Foster were having an affair. Which,
oh yeah. Yeah.
The headlines were hilarious, and I don't personally believe that. I'll have to dig into it a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because the newspaper or like the magazine that published it was The Inquirer, so obviously you can't drama. Trust that. I just thought it was kind of funny.
Yeah.
Because it was like, hold on, let me look up some of these headlines. Inquirer. Oh, yeah, see. Hillary did it. Hillary tells all. Hold on. I can't find the headlines of it, but it was like, it was funny. I was peeing myself really laughing. Funny. Okay, we're going to go back to the note that was found in Foster's bag, because I'm sure you are wondering about handwriting samples.
Oh, yeah.
Aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Park police decided to take a very laid-back approach to this whole thing, because, duh, mm-hmm. They're park police.
Right.
There were already suspicions that the note was planted in Foster's bag, so you'd think they would go in-depth on this, but no, they did not. Someone did examine the note and compare it to other writings by Foster, but the person who examined this, Sergeant Lockhart, was never certified as a handwriting expert.
Hmm.
So he wasn't even qualified to do this, and violated not only his own standards for protocol.
Just another...
Oh, sorry.
Unprofessional...
Just another day working in the White House. he violated not only his own standards, but protocol for examining handwriting. They only used one other writing to compare, and this one sample was obtained from family, which they're not supposed to do because close family and friends are considered suspects, of course.
Yep.
There were many red flags in this little area of the case, because where are there any green flags in this case?
Uh-huh.
I think the one thing we can all decide on was that Vincent Foster passed away. I think that's the one...
Yeah.
The one consistency.
Oh, sorry.
No, you're good. The note that was found was torn into 28 pieces, and the 28th piece was missing. And the piece that was missing would have most likely been where a date was written. There were no fingerprints on any pieces, just a partial palm print, so this would be consistent with someone who was wearing gloves while tearing the note up.
Hmm.
Tearing up a note is also a known technique that forgers use to make comparison difficult. And the other weird thing, yeah, so that is a known technique that forgers use to make comparison difficult. And the other weird thing is that the timing that this note was found, it was found right as the public started to question if this really was a suicide. And then, oh, boom, look, we have something that looks like a suicide note. How convenient.
Oh, so silly.
Yeah. One Republican senator gave a demonstration on how paper pieces could not be missed in an initial search, which, yes, that did happen. The note was somehow overlooked in the first search of Foster's belongings in his office. Mm-hmm. Not surprised. What happens next, Lily? It's not anything to do with the park police. You don't know what happens next.
I don't know. I don't remember. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. Two men named James Dale Davidson and Lord William Rees-Mogg.
Oh my gosh. I think I remember.
British AF.
Oh yeah.
Who co-authored an investment newsletter in 1995 came forward to hold a press conference to announce that the note that was found in Foster's bag was indeed a forgery, according to not one, not two, but three handwriting experts.
Dang.
Davidson was actually a close acquaintance of the Clintons, and he was invited to balls and events at the Clintons and also donated the maximum amount towards the Clintons' campaigns. And I'm quite impressed with this dude because even though he was super close with the Clintons, he believed Foster's death was a cover-up, and he knew how bad this could be for the Clintons if something like this large was covered up under their administration, who was already having issues. So he didn't want to blow everything out of the water, just kind of look at, like, different aspects of the case and let people form their own opinions, just like me. Just like us.
Right.
One of the aspects being the handwriting. One of the experts Davidson hired to examine the leaked note versus some of Foster's actual note writings has pretty impressive experience. So not gonna lie, I trust this dude. This is, like, the one guy that I trust in this case.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Reginald Alton.
Reginald.
He lectured for 30 years on handwriting, manuscript authentication, and forgery detection, and his statement was, and I quote, "It was not just a forgery, but an obvious forgery."
Dang.
And yet another expert agreed with the statement. So I think that's all I'm gonna... Oh, is this the... No, that's not the end. I did that last time, too. Yeah, so that's all I'm gonna say for... The handwriting segment of the episode, but the book goes way more in depth and analyzes the sentences, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, like I said, go read the book. It's a really good book. We also, yeah, okay, Robert B. Fisk. Here's some more background on Fisk.
All right.
Because I feel like I just owe it to this guy after not knowing who he is.
our guy Fisk.
Yeah, he's a prosecutor and was the one chosen to do an investigation into the Clintons after the death of Foster. So that is why there are reports in this case known as Fisk reports.
Nice.
Boom. There we go. Boom. Oh, that was you. I was like, oh, somebody DM'd me. It was you.
It was me.
The independent investigation was started because there were suspicions that Foster's death was linked to Whitewater. Since Foster was also a lawyer, he was working on some papers about that whole scandal.
Mm-hmm.
5 months after Foster's death, the Times reported that, according to park police, that the Whitewater papers had been taken out of Foster's office before the first known search began. Weird.
Mm-hmm.
The whole scandal had mostly been forgotten by the public until December of 1993, when the Washington Times published an article suggesting links between Whitewater and the death of Foster, and this made people go bananas, like insane, and the White House's reaction was to just let it blow over and don't say a word.
Classic.
It is kind of classic. Kind of reminds me of, like the royal family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just kind of like, oh.
Yep.
What you gonna do about it? get this, too. Man named James Hamilton, who was also a confidant of the Clintons, as well as the Foster family attorney. Wait, what? What else was I gonna say about him?
Huh?
Oh, okay. So, yeah, he had the same occupation as Foster.
Oh, okay.
He was the confidant of the Clintons as well as an attorney.
Oh, was he the childhood best friend? No.
No. Bill Clinton and Foster were childhood best friends.
Yeah, and then there was one more guy, wasn't there? That was also a childhood best friend?
Maybe.
Wasn't it the governor of...
Bill Clinton was the governor of Arkansas.
Oh, okay. But I thought there was...
Right? I think so. Anyways.
Anywho.
Yeah, so I'm not going to go into the details of the Clinton scandals. Y'all can go do that on your own.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what this episode is about.
No.
So Fisk, with his newfound responsibility to get into the case involving the Clintons and a strange death, set up two offices, one in Arkansas and one in Washington. Again, there's a lot more detail on this, but if I go into everything, it's going to be way too long. And yeah, we don't want that. I will get into Fisk's reports, and if we didn't get these reports, we may not have this book, and we definitely wouldn't have this episode. This report was super hyped up by news outlets, which isn't really to be expected, in my opinion. But in short, the reports and documents show that a real investigation never took place. Okay, here's this. I just have to clarify. I read over this section of the book talking about the Fisk reports and whether an actual investigation was done or not, because I don't know. Christopher Ruddy, you're an amazing writer, amazing author. You really go in depth, but please clear up what you mean by an investigation wasn't done, because I can't tell if Fisk didn't do a proper investigation or everyone else didn't do a proper investigation.
Honestly, it wouldn't surprise me if...
Both.
Both.
Yeah. But, like, I could not get a clarification on which one did or did not do a proper investigation, because we obviously know that, like, Park Police, FBI definitely didn't do a good job. But it kind of sounded like Fisk also didn't, because he only interviewed... Fisk investigators had only conducted interviews with the emergency workers who were on scene that night, and their testimony was super minimal and definitely not conclusive evidence of suicide. And... That's really all the only people he interviewed.
Mm.
So, but then he also references Fisk reports all the time in his own investigation. So I'm confused by that part. I could not get a clear answer. But I'm kind of leaning towards, like, Fisk's investigation kind of showed that everyone else did a bad job, because Christopher Reddy does reference Fisk reports in, like, almost every single aspect.
Yeah.
Of the case. So do with that information what you will. Like I said, read the book. But I think overall, an investigation wasn't done thoroughly by anyone. So what was also released is that Fisk and his team were having issues coming up with a decision on if Foster's death was indeed a suicide. So everyone was kind of wishy-washy on everything, which not surprising. Going back to our confidential witness... Fisk's investigators actually got to interview this confidential witness at his home and ask him about how he found the body, etc. So, what should we nickname him Jack?
Yeah.
Okay, so Jack was apparently just trying to go pee and climbed down the embankment Foster was found on and saw the body. He chose to remain anonymous because he was scared about how high profile of a case this was, and Fisk's team was hesitant to believe his story for some reason. Which is kind of whatever. Like, I guess investigators are supposed to be on the fence.
Right.
About everything. Get this. Fisk's investigators never bothered to double-check the identity of Jack with Francis Swan, who was one of the Park Police employees. And I believe I gave him the wrong occupation in the last episode.
Mm.
Francis Swan is a Park Police employee. Okay. No, not Park Police. Park employee.
Oh, okay.
Just clarifying. I think okay. I called him like an EMT worker last episode or something.
Oh, okay.
So, if we remember correctly, Foster was on a slope, and with the way that gravity works, things fall down. Thank you, Isaac Newton. Including dripping blood, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
He was laying at a 45-degree angle, so if there was blood dripping from his nose, it would drop down towards his feet.
Mm-hmm.
Blood trails on his body show that the blood was moving upwards towards his forehead, which is physically impossible, obviously. Investigators claimed his head was leaned back at an angle, but it's still not going to go that far back like it supposedly did. And this is insinuating that his body was moved to that slope at some point, but this piece of evidence was overlooked for some reason. Obviously.
Wonder why.
That is all I have for this episode.
All right.
Like I said, I will be posting pictures from the book.
Nice. That's exciting. I can't wait to see them.
They're actually really cool.
Yeah.
I might show them. Thanks for sticking with us, guys.
Yeah.
It's been a little rough. It's probably going to get rough again after I give birth, but that's to be expected.
We might have to take a little.
Yeah.
A little break.
We might have to just maybe close down the Patreon for a month.
Yeah.
Give y'all a break or two. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe I'll just get, a burst of motivation and I'll have, a bunch of episodes, prepared.
That would be a good idea.
Recorded. Because, I got so sick that I quit my job. So, I'm officially a stay-at-home
housewife. We're total opposites. I got a second job. Yeah.
Lily's a working girl.
Ugh. I wish I could quit my jobs.
Dude, I was like, I didn't want to sound super like lazy, but like, I'm so glad I got to quit my job, bro. Like, I liked making money, but I didn't want to quit, obviously, until I like was big pregnant or like had a kid already.
Right.
Because I was like, there's just so many things for me to be doing.
Waitressing when you're pregnant,
it's a lot of hard work. Yeah. I had a coworker text me last night that was like, hey, you quit, right? And I was like, kind of. Well, it's actually, I didn't even have to put in like a 2 weeks notice or anything. I just texted my manager and I was like, hey, can you take me off the schedule? I'm puking like a lot. So sorry. And she was like, oh yeah, no worries. So yeah, I'm basically done there. That's nice. And I had another coworker who was like, yeah, me and another guy just put in our 2 weeks notice. Like, it's going down.
Wow.
Over there. I guess we're going to close out this episode by saying thanks for listening. Thanks for sticking it out with us. We're still pretty new to this, not going to lie.
Yeah.
I feel like, dude, I can't believe we only have like 12 episodes and we've been doing this for like 6 months.
I know. It feels like we've recorded so many, but
I know. Yeah.
We really haven't.
Hopefully we like get in like a good groove.
I know.
Maybe. Because Frisbee season is ending. We have regionals this weekend.
Oh, exciting.
So we're gonna be in Oklahoma for like 4 days. And then after that, Frisbee's done, we're done with trips. Oh, then we have family vacation in October.
Mm.
And then the holidays are coming up. I don't know. Maybe we won't get on schedule. Who knows? And then I'm going to Oregon in January. But yeah, we'll see.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening. Go follow us on Instagram at UncoveredThePod.
Yeah.
Send us an email at theuncoveredpod@gmail.com.
I have no idea.
I think so. I hope so. Follow us on Twitter at UncoveredATCP. Go to our Patreon.
Yes.
Because I didn't know if y'all were aware or not, but the highest tier of our Patreon gets a bonus episode every month.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put in requests
mm-hmm.
for episodes for that month. And like, we got a request for this month, and I'm going to be doing, you know, maybe we'll feel crazy and throw in like 2 episodes. Just, you know, you never know.
You never know.
Oh, that sounds sexy. Yeah. That's about it.
Talk to you later.
Talk to y'all later.
Bye.
Emma and Lily signing off.
Out.
Out.